This is Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming nationwide on the 710 Sports app and 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Try to put on the show.
Exclamation point. Jamal Adams, a Seahawk, question mark? Good morning. It's Friday. It's July 10th. Welcome to Danny and Gallant and the Seattle Seahawks. Well, apparently they're hip deep in the Jamal Adams pursuit. That, according to our very own Jay Keeps, who, well, no sooner had he returned from a little time off than he dropped that little bit of news that Seattle is one of the teams that is active and in pursuit of the Jets. Former top 10 pick, one of the league's better safeties, Paul.
It's interesting that this is actually something they're considering because it makes me wonder about how they view their defense. Because I feel like there's only a couple of reasons that you want to make a trade and potentially overpay for Jamal Adams, which is not a move I would say no to, but I'm curious about what the asking price is. Either you don't have faith in the combination of Bradley McDougald or Marquise Blair at your other safety spot, or you don't know that Ugo Amadi is good enough to be your starting nickel corner, and maybe you're thinking about moving Marquise Blair into that spot.
Nickel could be something you figure out. If this is predicated on some idea about nickel cornerback, I'm going to kick something. Like, I'm going to kick a trash can really hard. Like, hard enough to actually maybe perhaps break my toe. Because nickel cornerbacks can be found. Right, that was Justin Coleman. They got him from the Patriots a week before training camp started. You can find a nickel cornerback. You should be able to find a nickel cornerback. That shouldn't
didn't find one last year though.
That shouldn't be determining exactly what you end up doing with a potential big budget addition, which is what I think Jamal Adams would be. Well, let's let Jake Heaps explain what he's heard, what he knows about Seattle's pursuit of the player.
I actually had a conversation with a friend of mine who works in a front office on the other side of the country for an NFL team. And we were talking and he actually said, so your Seahawks are really into Jamal Adams. And I was like, excuse, like, what do you mean by that? Right. Yeah. Like, okay, I'm interested. I'm interested. and they're another team that's interested in Jamal Adams. And he said, yeah, the Seahawks are absolutely pursuing the Seahawks. Or the Seahawks are absolutely pursuing Jamal Adams in this situation.
There's a lot of things that could be going on there. You could have the possibility of a potential market being generated for a player. There's the idea of course the Seahawks are going to pursue. They've definitely been open and aggressive and say they're always in on everything. And there's also the possibility that they're really determined to get him. And that this, in fact, so let's operate off of that assumption. Seattle wants
it. Okay.
Is that the right move? Should Seattle be going hard after him? Because on the surface of it, he'd be the team's leading sacker, but it's not really the biggest need. He's not going to make your team worse. Your team's going to get better. You get a guy who was, what, the number six overall pick, is considered one of the top four or five safeties in the league, a guy who is big and punishing and runs like he does. You're not going to be worse for having him. Yeah, absolutely. And you look at last year, how much better their defense got when they got Quandre Diggs. They got Quandre Diggs, who I think was an above average, like a little bit more than adequate. And you saw the difference he made because, man, they didn't really have anything. Like, they were really lacking. Tedrick Thompson was a problem for their defense. And once they got Quandre Diggs in there, that was a huge upgrade. So, yeah, I can get beyond. He'd make their defense better.
He would make their defense better, but how much better would he make the defense? I mean, you have Quandre Diggs at safety, and you're hoping that Marquise Blair turns into something. Your biggest problem last year was the pass rush. Your second biggest problem, as was exposed by the Green Bay Packers, is that your cornerback group, to put it kindly, lacked confidence after Shaquille Griffin, if not actual talent. And those are the two positions that I feel like are the biggest question marks going into this season. I don't think safety was. They have Quandre Diggs now. I think Bradley McDougald is a perfectly adequate player. Yeah, you could do better than him, and that's what I think what they're hoping Marquise Blair could theoretically do, seeing as he was a second-round pick last season. I am open to the idea of making a move for him, but I also realize it's going to be expensive, and that expense is my big holdup right now.
How much should they give up for him? What should be the limit? Because if you trade for him, you're trading for a guy that has 1 year of relatively affordable contract left, and then after that would be franchise tag level. You're trading for a guy who is about to get paid. You're not getting, and one of the big benefits you get with even a first round pick and a second round pick is that you get cost controlled, the potential of cost controlled stars. No guarantee you're going to get a star, but if you get a really good player there, he's cost controlled. You'd be giving up your ticket for that possibility to get a guy who's about to be really expensive. That's what you'd be trading for. What's your limit on what you give up?
It really depends on how confident you are that you would be able to keep him around past those 2 years. Because I think if you can keep him past those 2 years, okay, then every single draft pick should be on the table. And if you take a look at the contract situations for their safeties, you have in Bradley McDougal, I believe, a guy whose contract is expiring. And in Quandre Diggs, you have a guy who is affordable for the next season or so. And then after that, 2 seasons. And then after that, okay, you might be moving on from him. So theoretically,
first round pick, Paul, you going to give it up? First round pick to acquire Jamal Adams. You get him for 1 year, and then he is absolutely at the end. He would want an extension no later than 12 months from now.
Only if you give him an extension. But, I mean, given that they haven't given Jadeveon Clowney an extension for the impact he had last season, why would they give Jamal Adams an extension?
Well, it would be you'd be acquiring him with the idea that that would happen. They traded for Jadeveon Clowney, knowing that he would go into free agency. Would you pay a first round pick for the right to pay him a top five safety contract?
No. I mean, I don't know how good he is. I think he's good. He's been on a Jets team, so maybe he's held back by the fact that they stink and he's not really able to play from a position of where that team's ahead, and that means that he's basically being sent on blitzes more than he's sitting back potentially making plays in coverage. First-round pick, right now, I can't pull the trigger on that one.
How good would he make the defense? Here's Jake Heaps.
I think that could be a really dynamic trade and a big boost for the Seahawks that could really make that defense and that defensive backfield back to that Legion of Boom type of status again, because Jamal Adams, as much as we reminisce about Cam Chancellor, Jamal Adams is a generational talent at that position and plays very similarly to Cam.
He is more similar to Cam. I think that throughout Cam's career, his impact was underestimated, and that we always assumed that Earl Thomas was the one who was the rare talent and the guy that absolutely was the difference maker back there. I still feel that thumper, that's the kind of guy that you can find. And if Jamal Adams, one of his major strengths is his ability to come forward and rush the passer, that you're paying a premium. You're paying a premium for a guy in a defense that they don't have the safeties really do that all that much. They need a center fielder. And Quandre Diggs being that guy, or Marquise Blair being that guy, I don't think Jamal Adams is the center fielder. I think that's the value in this defense, of getting a guy with incredible range. And I think you'd be paying a premium to get a guy whose best asset is, well, it's something you kind of already hope you might have in Marquise Blair, and I know that there's no guarantee. And trading draft picks to pay guys big contracts, that's something that has not worked here, and it is a quick way to run through your cap space and flexibility fast. I'm not interested in Jamal Adams. I think he's a good player, but unless you're going to get him for a third or a fourth round pick, I'm not interested in him.
If you're making your defense similar to the way that wide receivers are sometimes described, into a bit of a Swiss Army knife, you have Quandre Diggs, who can play a little center field, but is also great at thumping people. You have Marquise Blair, who is great at thumping people. You have both of those guys. You have Diggs the next 2 seasons. You have Blair the next 3 seasons. Do you really want to bring in somebody else who's best known for, at this point in time, being a thumper? I'm with you. I feel like what you need to find, if you're going to trade for some defensive back, is someone who is getting takeaways at a very advanced clip, or is creating absolute chaos for whatever quarterback potentially throws his way.
It's Danny and Gallant. Right now, it is time for us to tell you what to watch for.
What to watch for every morning at 7:10. Brought to you by Dubin Law Group. The first look at the stories worth watching today with Danny and Gallant.
The high school football season is in doubt in Texas. And I feel there's very few statements that ring the sound of Armageddon quite like that one. If they're not going to play high school football in Texas, what hope do we all have for any sort of sports in the fall? I'm overstating it, but only slightly. And that was
I don't
Dallas.
I'm not overstating it at all. The Dallas. I mean, this is
The Dallas superintendent said to MSNBC that he's not quite sure how the state can pull it off. No decisions yet, but it certainly looks like it's in doubt.
Definitely. And look, this is one of those things where when you hear that this state is doing it, like, seriously, that is, as you described it, Danny, as close to Armageddon as you can get. I mean, that's a state that loves high school football unlike any other. And we're talking about small communities who come together around these teams, especially in the western part of the state or in these parts of the state where there isn't, you know, they're not very close to a city. I am bummed out hearing this news. Legitimately bummed out, because it would seem like they would go all in on trying to make a season happen if they could.
What to watch for?
Hey, guess what? More bad news. Michigan against Washington. Nope, not happening. Ohio State versus Oregon. Nope, not happening.
I'm looking forward to the Bucks smashing the Ducks.
The Big Ten is likely going to decide it won't play out-of-conference football games this season. The SEC is scheduled to meet and have conversations about what they're going to do for this coming season today. This is also, as we just described in What to Watch For number one, an Armageddon-ish bummer as far as a full college football season. I don't know if this is the end point, Danny, as far as games that potentially get nixed.
Yeah, it kind of seems like this is the coal in the canary mine, right? Where all of a sudden everything else is going to follow suit. You're not going to correct my metaphor. That was done deliberately to try and...
The cat in the canary mine.
Yeah, the other Power 5 conferences. And honestly, this is just buying time. Eliminating the non-conference schedule is trying to buy time and say, okay, maybe if we start later in September, maybe if we start in October, we'll be able to get some semblance of a season in. All very, very negative signs as it points to a college football season.
What to watch for?
And it's the Seahawks, whose season ticket holders can receive refunds on their season tickets for 2020, or they can pause their season ticket purchase and essentially transfer their purchase over to 2021. This comes as teams around the country sort of indicate that and concede that it's probably not going to be business as usual in the stands. They're probably not going to have full stands. They haven't said no spectators, but we're starting to look at the steps toward, if there are spectators, they're certainly not going to be full stadiums.
This is the right move. Every team should do this right now. And if you haven't done this already, then honestly, I would just consider your organization to be cheap. This should be done for maybe next season as well. I'm curious about putting the payments towards 2021. Do you feel like we're going to have full stadiums in 2021?
No, I don't.
I don't either.
I'm still hopeful we're going to have an NFL season. I do not see a scenario in which it's going to be stadiums filled up as we're used to seeing. I'm not even sure if you're going to see the 14,000 people in a 60,000 seat stadium. I don't know, but I don't think that there's any scenario in which you're going to see full stadiums.
Are we in agreement that there will be no fans at football games this year?
No, I'm not willing to go that far. We don't know. This thing changes so frequently, and a month ago everything looked like it was moving back toward a restart. I'm confident in being able to predict what's going to happen, what looks like it'll happen 2 weeks from now. A month from now I might have a general idea. 2 months from now, I'm not in the business of making any predictions about that.
That is true.
Says outlook is cloudy.
And we are still 2 months away from the start of the regular season, so that's potentially possible.
It is Danny and Gallant. One last little bit of news. Quentin Dunbar, the Seahawks cornerback, has asked the Florida court for permission to travel outside the state. This comes from Daniel Wallach, who is a legal analyst for The Athletic. It is unopposed, and the motion is, and it points to the fact that DeAndre Baker, his co-defendant, was given that permission. So expect Quentin Dunbar to be available when training camp starts here coming up at the end of the month. It is Danny and Gallant. It's now time to bring in the Professor John Clayton for our morning drive.
John Clayton's Morning Drive with Danny and Gallant.
It's a four-way battle, and there's only going to be three spots. Somebody has to go.
The first and final word on everything NFL from the Professor John Clayton.
Presented by DivorceLawyersForMen.com.
They scored 30 points a game. They're the best running team in football.
It's John Clayton's Morning Drive with Danny and Gallant.
Professor, based off of what we were hearing from Jake Heaps yesterday, do you feel that the Seahawks are likely to make a trade for Jamal Adams?
No, I don't. I think that that's like in anything that John Snyder does. He keeps his hands in just about every possible option. But, how does it fit? Because, again, you're giving up value and you're going to bring in somebody that's going to be, commanding $15 million a year. And so it's nice to be able to do it if obviously somebody's going to give it to you. I mean, look what happened in the last year. They've been able to get for 2 fifth-round picks, a Pro Bowl caliber cornerback and Quentin Dunbar and a Pro Bowl caliber safety. And so why would you even want to bring in another safety? But again, you always keep looking because you never know if you can get the right deal. But this is a deal that's not going to happen.
Big picture economics, John. Safeties have become a little less valuable. Like, it seems like their contracts have come down over the past couple years. Is Jamal Adams the exception? Is he going to sort of redefine the payment for that position?
No,
it's
gone up. I mean, Eddie Jackson got 14.6 in Chicago. You can see the value of that, but it's been a little bit of a rebound. I mean, you saw that Earl Thomas got a pretty decent deal. So right now, the level of pay for a safety at the top, and that's what Jamal Adams is going to get. Now, if he wants 17 to 20, no way possible, but 15 is probably his number, or 14.8 is probably his number.
John, we also just had the news about the Seahawks offering refunds on 2020 season tickets. We've seen a number of teams offering options for fans who aren't going to use their tickets. Do we expect fans in the stands this year at NFL games, or is it too soon to tell?
Too soon to tell. Nobody can make that. I mean, it's still, I think the odds aren't very good at all that it's going to happen. But again, to make a judgment like this is going to be, it's 32 different teams and 32 different situations. I guess you could say 31 or 30 because, the Meadowlands, the old Meadowlands and the Los Angeles stadiums, have two teams each. But, this is going to, because again, first off, it has to be agreed upon by the local municipalities in coordination with the teams. And so nobody knows how that's going to go. So, to say no would be too early, but still, I think the odds aren't very good. And by the way, Seahawks are the 14th team to offer the package that they did as far as what to do with the season tickets.
We saw the Big Ten has canceled out-of-conference college football games for this season, and I'm wondering, John, if the NFL has contingency plans right now, because clearly college football is okay with canceling some games. Dan Patrick suggested on his show that the NFL does have some sort of contingency plan. I'm just curious as to what that actually might entail.
Well, what it is that in the first couple of weeks of the season, they have some ways for example, they have, I think, weeks two and four, they match up as far as bye weeks where you can move things back if you have to cancel weeks 2 and 4. And then if you have to do something with week 3, you can do it that way. So they built into the schedule, and really they did this back in 2011 that they had contingency plans that it's okay if we don't have a CBA done by then we can move this and move that. So they do have contingency plans, but right now the plan is to go ahead and have the season start on time.
John, I think I found a place for Colin Kaepernick to sign.
Okay.
The Los Angeles Rams. Their current backup is John Wolford.
Mm-hmm.
Sean McVay is their head coach.
Right.
McVay is kind of part of the Kyle Shanahan coaching tree. I believe McVay was in Washington when the Shanahans were there,
mm-hmm.
and Robert Griffin III was there. I actually think that a backup for Goff, Kaepernick, might be interesting. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Could be, because, I mean, you add a little bit more running to the offense, and that's one of the things that McVay has learned from Kyle Shanahan and executes very well, and that's the importance of a running game. But, don't know if they want to really bring in a new quarterback at this stage. And again, when you look at their backup, you're right. He's the least known of any of the 32 backup quarterbacks in the league. So, yeah, I can see it being a possible fit, but right now we've basically not seen any interest coming from the Rams and Kaepernick.
Seahawks cornerback Quentin Dunbar filed for permission to travel for work. That request was granted per records, and he should report to training camp on July 28th. But this, I imagine, situation that he may or may not have gotten himself into based off his attorney, Michael Grieco, is going to be hanging over his head for perhaps quite some time. Do you feel that we could have a punishment for Dunbar before anything is put down just because the NFL might be embarrassed? Or is this one of those things where he might end up getting suspended midway through the year?
Yeah, I think I'm just wondering because, again, trying to guess how Roger Goodell's staff and makes decisions on these, you know, sometimes it's impossible because, I mean, we've seen it with Ezekiel Elliott. We've seen it. It's like we just can't figure it out sometimes. There's no pattern to it. But, you know, in this case, I think that they would just probably let the case go on and see where it goes because, you know, now both attorneys or the three attorneys combined are all saying that this thing they expect is going to be dropped at some point, but the prosecution continues to wait and wait and wait and see which way they're going to go. But so at this, it's the possibility they could put them on the exempt list until this is resolved. But you kind of get the feeling out of the courts as if it's going to go and get prosecuted. This thing is going to take months and may go into who knows when, next year, fall, all that stuff. But I still wonder, you know, why the prosecution doesn't just drop the case when you have victims allegedly claiming that they're not victims.
There's also the really funny, it's not funny, it's a serious allegation. But when you've got a defense attorney who basically shows up and says, hey, all these people that said something happened, they've now signed statements that said nothing happened, this charge shouldn't even be, it should be dropped. It should be dropped right away. And then like a week later, you're like, hey, did that charge get dropped? And they're like, no, it's still going on. But it should totally be dropped. It's totally going to get dropped. There's no way that they can. And then a couple weeks later, you're like, hey, whatever happened to that charge? Oh, it's going to get dropped, I'm telling you. And then when I see earlier this week that he hired another lawyer, I'm like, that doesn't sound like something that's getting dropped if he's having to hire another lawyer. It certainly seems like things are progressing, John.
Yeah, you would think so. But I mean, the question is, how would you call it, define it as progressing? Because, again, you would have to think that just like in all court systems, I mean, they're so backed up on things. And, you know, particularly, you know, with the riots and everything else, all those things have to, you know, go into the court system. And so, you know, it's like it just looks like it's going to take time. Hey, look at the Michael Kendrick situation. You know, that still hasn't been resolved. It's now what going into the second year.
Yeah. Do you remember when Jim had to pay me $100 last year?
No. What was that for?
Because he bet that Michael Kendricks
wasn't going to be available
for the start of training camp because he'd be in jail. Uh-huh. I could have won that bet 2 years in a row with him. It would have been great.
I know.
Professor, we always appreciate your time. Want you and Pat to stay safe this weekend, and we'll talk to you next week.
All right, sounds good.
Thanks, Sean.
That is the Professor John Clayton. You can hear him right after us. It's the John Clayton Show that comes on from 10 to noon. The Seahawks format is tried and true, yet perhaps, well, football teams are coming to the line. Do they have their audibles lined up? Contingency plans in the NCAA and NFL coming up next.
You're listening to Danny and Gallant.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
The Big Ten is moving to a conference-only model for all fall sports. And you would imagine that there are many dominoes to fall after a very, very difficult decision that will cancel a game between Washington and Michigan, that will cancel a game between Oregon and Ohio State, Danny. And I'm wondering, what does this mean?
I think it's a point that conferences are trying to buy a little bit of time. This is not a solution. This is a time-buying measure. It's conferences hoping that maybe they can salvage some segment of the season, and they're just putting off a final decision. And that's unfortunate for everybody that, like me, that's hoping for college football. But I've thought really throughout the past month that college football has the toughest, has the largest number of obstacles to overcome because there's no national governing body. And the NCAA is kind of, did you see the NCAA's statement yesterday? Like it was on Twitter. Yeah. As the COVID pandemic continues to impact college sports nationally, the NCAA supports its members as they make important decisions based on their specific circumstances and in the best interest of college athletes' health and well-being, period. That said nothing. And honestly, that's not the NCAA's job. They're not, they have member institutions. They work for the institutions, although you wouldn't know that sometimes. There's no centralized governing body. And when you see the different ways that regions were impacted initially and how they're being impacted now, getting some sort of uniform and really national plan to return was always going to be hard. I think the Big Ten's announcement, I think all the other conferences will follow suit very soon. You'll see all interconference matchups canceled, and I think that conferences are going to hope that 2 weeks from now the outlook is different and they don't have to start canceling conference games.
The ACC is expected to change things the same way that the Big Ten has. The SEC is expected to meet with and have that conversation to determine whether or not they're going to play out of conference games, but it might not be in their, might not be in their ballpark anymore. I'm curious as to how conference games might work. Do you have to cancel a conference game that's been scheduled in advance? Can you reschedule the conference games if you're college football? Because certain conferences have staggered conference schedules where you might be playing a conference game in week two, or maybe you're playing a conference game in week three. And if you're trying to buy time, I'm curious as to if college football could find a way to potentially push some of these back, especially if you're getting rid of, for some teams, four, maybe even five games.
Colleges hope they have to make those decisions. Honestly, like, that would be having to prioritize or come up with a way to have a college football season is a luxury. The direction that things are going right now with the hospitalizations, specifically in three of the largest states, California, Texas, and Florida, the infection rates that are being seen around the country, point, if it doesn't get better, I don't see a scenario where they think they're going to be able to play college football at all. If it gets better, if the trends start to change a little, then maybe we'll see the possibility that, hey, we could finagle in a conference season. But I see yesterday's announcement as pretty clear writing on the wall that the outlook right now is really grim, and barring a change in direction nationally, we're probably not going to see college football.
It's Danny and Gallant. College football clearly scared right now. It does seem, though, Danny, like they get it more than the NFL right now, right?
No, I actually think the NFL has a shot of playing. Like the NFL, unlike college football, has a national unifying organization, and it has guidelines that it can put into place to keep people and to monitor their health. It has more resources than college football programs do. You can't. Part of the challenge with colleges is the University of Illinois at Champaign going to have the same level of testing that another school does in Iowa? Is it going to have the same level of testing as another school at Washington does? And all of those, the NFL, the answer could be yes. They will have a unified testing procedure. I think there's a much better chance that the NFL season happens as scheduled. In fact, I don't see reason right now to say, nope, there's no way football's being played.
It could be, yes. The big thing with the NFL, though, as a governing body is, while they do have all these resources, are we going to act like we trust the governing body to put those resources to good use? Because I don't feel that way about Goodell and the league executives, and I don't really get the feeling that there's a backup plan that they have available, no matter what they might be leaking and hinting to those who are in the media.
Yeah, if it's incompetent, I could... Yeah, you're right. If it's incompetent, this could be a house of cards. I actually think it's also different because of the players that we're talking about. I think there's a different standard for college athletes. They're not paid employees. As much as we talk about that they should be and that they are in effect employees, they're not. And my feeling of, should you ask a college football player if he wants to play and take him and let him decide that? I think it's different. NFL players are pros. I think your responsibility to them is to tell them actually the safety measures that are in place and give them as good as you can an estimate of risk. And maybe they won't, because there's certainly the concussions and the lawsuits from the 80s are that the NFL knew more about concussions than it told its players. But I think you can ask an NFL player to make a reasonable, hey, here's what we're going to do to try to keep you from getting sick. We can't guarantee you won't get sick. Do you want to play? And I guess I feel much more comfortable, I don't think it's unethical to let an NFL player decide that. I think it is. I think there's a real moral question when it comes to college athletes and letting them decide if they want to play.
I'm with you on that front. But when it comes to the actual season itself, while the NFL does have only 16 games for the regular season on its side, a smaller playoffs, though it is expanding this year, than all but baseball when it comes to how the postseason goes down, I think this idea that you're going to be able to control team employees, and even with this tier system that they have described, where certain people are going to have certain access to certain levels of the stadium, it's a lot of people for an NFL team. And we're just talking about the roster before we talk about the big coaching staffs and then everything else, every single person that works for these teams. And I don't think that they should be going right now without some sort of backup plan that involves some sort of a bubble. And I actually did create a very rough, hastily made contingency plan for the league, because I don't trust that they have one right now. So here's what we're going to do, Danny.
I want to hear Paul's bubble.
Okay, four regional bubbles. Each team plays 10 to 11 games in it, so you buy yourself a little bit of time. You combine each conference's divisions into mega divisions, so you got the NFC and the AFC West. Those eight teams play in one host city. So you got like four different host cities, find a bunch of hotels, find a couple of fields for everybody. Each team plays six division games like you normally do. You play four out-of-conference games, and if you want to add an extra one so that it's an 11-game season, you play two games against whatever team finished in the same place as you last season in the other division. So you're going to have an 11-game season, which is weird, right? But I think this way you can control the situation a lot better than you would be able to if we're talking about 32 different teams. Here's the big thing that I have an issue with. Yes, NFL teams have more resources across the board, but teams like the Bengals, teams like the Raiders, teams that don't exactly have the best finances and have different, I think, methods and mindset about things, I don't trust every single organization to do what the NFL says. I understand that the governing body is stronger than what the NCAA has, but the actual enforcement and execution of it, that is something that I am not 100% sure that the NFL can handle.
But other people are returning to work, right? Like other industries are coming back to work. And other places going to work in factories and coming out. And we have national standards, but it varies in location to location how safety conscious different employers are. And if you're a worker and you make the decision, and look, there's part of it. I get that there's a huge privilege in deciding that I either am able to work from home or I'm financially comfortable enough that I choose not to work right now. But if you lay it out and say, hey, it's your decision about whether you go to work or not, and they're like, I don't trust the Bengals, you're like, okay, that's fair. You can choose not to play. But if you choose to play, I guess I think that and still see that there's a shot. I don't think that this is doomed. I don't think that the NFL's plan is doomed. And I think that if you do have enough testing, that you will be able to keep the virus from spreading within locker rooms.
I don't think it's doomed yet. But I also don't trust them to have a backup plan because they're very stubborn. It's Danny and Gallant, 710 ESPN Seattle. The Seahawks format is tried and true. And yet, I am wondering if they'd benefit from trying something new in a place that you probably haven't considered. Let's see if Danny's going to drag his feet about those changes next.
You are listening to Danny and Gallant.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
A national tragedy occurred last night. The NBA silenced J.R. Smith's Instagram live broadcast. J.R. Smith, who is... He's one of the league's more... untethered personalities, I'll say. A guy that you're never quite sure what
polite.
He's going to do. Yeah, like J.R. Smith is, I don't think he's a necessarily mean-spirited person, but he does some loony stuff, like throw soup at an assistant coach, whoop on a guy who damaged his truck at the time of the social protest, but as J.R. Smith pointed, it wasn't part of the social protest. The guy just tried to mess up his truck, so he smashed him.
I have an idea right now, and if anyone's listening who knows how to create television shows, you are going to give me half of your money. If there is ever going to be a television show based off of an athlete, J.R. Smith is 100% the athlete to base it off of. He's not amazing, he's a controversial, anti-hero-esque figure, and he just does rascalous things along the way.
Yeah, he is someone who's unpredictable. He was Instagramming live, which is the same as basically an internet broadcast, right? Like, you all of a sudden, your phone becomes a television camera, and you're, anyone on Instagram can look what you're up to. And he was walking around his room, which showed he had no blankets, that there was no comforter on his bed, which he found to be amusing. The best part, though, is that he went and got his food, which was left at his door, and then started showing the phone and rotating around the different hallways so you could see all the other players coming out. You're like, it's like summer camp. Like, that's what it looks like. Like, everybody's like, hey, what's up, man? Hey, JR, how are you doing? I don't know. You got some Lunchables? Talked about the fruit by the foot he was eating, and then he got a text from someone that said, yeah, you need to stop live stream. You can't do that. So that was halted, which ruins everybody's fun. I mean, we're just trying to have a good time. Come on. We got a national quarantine that's happening and in these trying times, but we can't even get J.R. Smith Instagram live. It's really too bad.
If you want a drama of excitement for the NBA, then let J.R. Smith J.R. Smith. J.R. Smith is the best unintentional comedy or intentional comedy. Maybe he's just this mischievous artist that's been doing things this way for a long time that all sports needs right now.
All right, Paul, we're gonna talk about the Seahawks defense, and we're going to use a term that Dave Wyman loves in particular, single high safety, right, which is essentially a way of saying a cover three defense. And it's a zone where you have a safety with the deep middle, one safety back, and then the corners are on the backside, on the outside. It's cover three. There's three guys that basically are responsible for setting the back of the defense. They have to keep everything in front of them. And the question is, Andy Benoit was talking with Ryan Russillo on a Ringer podcast, was talking about the difficulty that zone defenses have enforcing turnovers. Here he is talking about
if that. You're going to be a zone defense, then you still need the pass rush, even though the numbers say, well, it might not be as important in cover three. There were only eight cases all season long, eight total plays where a zone defender tipped a ball and it was intercepted by another zone defender. So it's not like having all these zone guys downfield is making everything happen. You still have to impact the QB in some way to make a bad throw.
And that builds off of a point and a criticism that people have of teams that play a cover three zone, of which Seattle is one of the most prominent. Seattle has been part of a movement. It's spread, certainly Dan Quinn, Gus Bradley. San Francisco plays it with Robert Saleh, who was an assistant coach here in Seattle, which is, it doesn't force the opponent into turnovers. It waits for the opposing quarterback to make mistakes. And the question is whether that is something, a format that Seattle should look at changing. What did you hear when you listened to Benoit's point?
So when I heard that, I heard that this is a defense that sits back and is relying on quarterbacks messing up. So Benoit went back and he cataloged every single interception this past season and as to why it happened and which were the faults of quarterbacks and which were the faults of a defense actually making an impact on the play. And it just wasn't happening a whole lot with those cover three defenses. So when I heard that, I thought to myself, Danny, all right, well, maybe if the Seahawks want to do better in pass coverage and help out the pass rush, should they explore potentially changing the defense to maybe a scheme that involves more man principles as opposed to what they seem to run the most? And I'm sure that they every now and then jazz it up a little bit, the cover three, which seems to have been their bread and butter for almost a decade.
And that's kind of the point in general that Benoit was making.
When you get to single high zone coverage, cover three, which is what the Seahawks play a lot, or the Niners, or the Jaguars, the pass rush only factors in on 30% of those plays, even though we hear all the time those teams are built on their four-man rush. And that surprised a lot of coaches. A few coaches were not surprised by that because they said, well, yeah, if there's two deep safeties, the quarterback has to hold the ball longer. If there's one deep, it's a pretty obvious read. But we got into those kind of things. What variations of zone coverage related to the pass rush result in turnovers?
It's oversimplified, but the question you're asking is, should Seattle be more aggressive?
Correct. Like
should Seattle, instead of sitting in a zone, and specifically a cover three zone, should they be doing something that makes it harder for the quarterback to find open targets and makes him hold the ball a little bit longer, and that gives your pass rush a chance to get home?
I see the logic of it. The reason that I think it's wrong is because when you look at Seattle's format and what they've used, you never have players that go somewhere else and become better. Because that's the question you're asking with any defensive scheme is, does this scheme get the most out of the guys I have? Like that's really at your root of it is this a template? Is this the style of defense we're playing? Does it allow our players to have the most impact they can have? And over the course of the 10 years, I think that it does. I think that the style that Pete plays, and it is Pete is the consistent theme, because even before you get into would he be willing to change it, look, is there evidence that there are talents and players that this team doesn't make the most of because they're too passive, because they're too... And going through, and there are guys, Jacob Martin had a good season last year, but Byron Maxwell, Brandon Browner, Walter Thurmond, like all of those guys were guys that got contracts elsewhere, but they never played as well elsewhere as they did with the Seahawks. And even pass rushers, Clinton McDonald, like they've had a number of guys, and I think it's partly to Seattle's credit that you haven't seen, I don't see a compelling case. Was Bruce Irvin a better player in Oakland and then in Atlanta and Carolina than he was in Seattle? I don't think he was. He was a more expensive player, but I don't think he was a better player. So I actually think that I think that the experience there points to the fact that I think they get the most out of their guys with the scheme and the format that they play.
And if they are getting the most out of their guys, then to change things just now, that would be foolish because you need some time to do a reset. You need to bring in personnel where there's guys who play better in man coverage and potentially get some different pieces in the front seven as well that can maybe do things that are, I don't know, more conducive to a defense that is based on man principles. But yes, they are getting the most out of what they can. The problem is, I am now wondering, okay, well, if this is all you have and you're seeing guys, yes, some players are walking away and they're not having success, but I mean, now you don't have Richard Sherman, now you don't have Earl Thomas. Is it time to explore something different when both of those guys, I mean, that's two-thirds of the deep field perfectly covered. Earl Thomas is maybe the best center fielder we've seen this century. As far, you know, we saw a little bit of Ed Reed in the early 2000s. So maybe let's just say this, Pat, in the 2010s, Earl Thomas is number one as far as center fielders. And Richard Sherman, as far as being a cornerback on one side of the field, all right, you're in great shape. It's different now. It's different. Like the talent level is different. So I'm wondering if that's something they would consider. Obviously, they've been doing it for a long period of time. I doubt that they're going to listen to Paul Gallant's ramblings and say all of a sudden, oh, wow, Paul's got a point here. But given the way that the defense worked last season, the pass rush did not get to the quarterback often, and quarterbacks seemed to find a lot of open holes in that defense and carve the Seahawks up. Those are two things that I wonder if they will continue next season, because perhaps the defense and the way that the Seahawks do things because of their talent has been figured out.
Let's ask Michael Bumpus about this. We'll bring him into the conversation. And also, it's possible that they've just significantly overlooked. ESPN has... Why is Chris Carson not among the league's top 10 running backs? We'll ask Michael coming up next in Blue 42.